a very good afternoon to one and all. Welcome once again to another edition of What's Cooking. And my goodness, how time flies. Seems no time at all since I was here bringing you last month's show. I hope you're all well and ready to enjoy another food-packed programme. So, without further ado, what's cooking? Today I'm going to talk about pastry. So, what then can we say about pastry? What is it? How is it made? How is it used? Well, listen on and you might just learn something you didn't know. The many different kinds of pastry which are made in Britain today have evolved over the centuries from a crude flour and water dough mixture invented by the Romans. The paste was wrapped around meat and game before roasting and was not intended to be eaten. It served only to retain meat juices and aroma. As time passed, the pastry was enriched with fat and milk and began vaguely to resemble today's short crust. By medieval times, pastry making was well established and had two rather different uses. Firstly, pastry was used to make tarts, which were very popular at medieval feasts. Interestingly, they didn't have the sweet or savoury distinction that we do now. All sorts of things were served on the table at the same time, and even the so-called savoury dishes would often be sweet. The hangover from this, of course, is mince pies. Here are a few types of medieval tarts. Custard tarts, a cross between a custard tart and a cheesecake. This still survives in Yorkshire to this day. Curd tarts. It tasted like a sweet quiche, a mixture of cream cheese, egg, and cream and spice. Tarte de brie. This was made from very ripe brie or cream cheese and was flavoured with saffron and ginger. Spinach tart. A spinach tart filled with currants, sugar, and spices. Fried pastries, a bit like samosas. They would often be filled with fruit or meat. They enjoyed having fun with their food in the medieval ages and often served pastry subtleties, which were tabletop jokes, such as the 4-and-20 blackbird's dish, recently recreated by Heston Blumenthal. The second usage of pastry was not as a foodstuff. People would make a rough flour and water rye pastry, often called a coffin, which was designed to protect whatever food was inside and then thrown away. For example, pastry was used to cover food while it was cooked in the oven to ensure it didn't burn, or used as a protective shell to transport food, and therein lies the origin of the pasty. Pasties are often thought of as a working class meal. Pastry was indeed very cheap, as it was just flour and water, but originally pasties were upper class dishes, often containing venison and other expensive meats, well beyond the grasp of the ordinary working class family. However, pasty fillings did become less expensive over the next few centuries, and in the 1800s, Cornish tin miners would often take pasties down into the mines for their meals. These miners' pasties contained savoury at one end and sweet at the other. Again, the pastry wasn't designed to be eaten, as their hands were filthy, so they would eat the inside and then throw the pastry away. Moving into the 19th century, pastry was once again used as a means of display by the upper classes. At wealthy dinner parties, game pies displayed what was available on the estate, and extremely elaborate pies with layers of rabbit, chicken, mushroom and ham were produced. They had fluted sides and the tops were domed with beautiful glazed pastry decoration. While the methods and ingredients of pastry have remained very similar throughout the centuries, a few unique types also emerged, such as potato pastry, which originated in Ireland in the 18th century. Unfortunately, this variety was not so popular across the water, where potatoes were regarded with a lot of suspicion because they weren't mentioned in the Bible, although some Catholics got around this by sprinkling the offending vegetables with holy water and planting them on Good Friday. However, during World War II, a lot of effort was put into researching non-rationed recipes, and potato pastry was resurrected as it used available vegetables rather than imported flour and rationed fat. It was made either with cooked mashed potato, which produced a very sticky and soft pastry, or with grated raw potato, which produced a slightly grey pastry, although the taste was much better, apparently. The use of pastry nowadays is wider than ever before. From convenient, ready-to-roll pastry and popular pastry-based international foods like Chinese dumplings and Indian samosas, it is a staple of many diets. Perhaps we may even one day see the re-emergence of the miner's pasty, savoury at one end and sweet at the other. Now, that would be convenient. Short crust pastry is the easiest type of pastry to make. It's also very versatile, as it readily incorporates other flavourings. It can be used for sweet or savoury pies and tarts, pasties and other pastry parcels. Regular short crust pastry is bound with water, but for a richer version, the water is replaced with egg. Moving on now to puff pastry. Puff pastry has a much higher fat content than short pastries and uses a special rolling and folding technique to create fine layers of dough that trap air between them. The pastry then puffs up on baking, creating scrumptious leaves with a light texture and rich flavour. This is one pastry that really is impressive. So, how do we make puff pastry? For this recipe, you will need 225 grams, 8 ounces plain flour, plus extra for rolling out, half a teaspoon fine salt, 250 grams, 9 ounces unsalted butter, cold but not rock hard, or you can use half butter, half lard, 150 mils, quarter of a pint ice cold water, and
this is what you do.
1. Sift the flour and salt into a large mixing bowl, then put the bowl in the fridge for a few minutes to chill. Keeping the flour and bowl cold will help you get a better result later and create nice layers of pastry. 2. Meanwhile, cut the butter into small cubes. 3. Using a round bladed knife, stir the butter into the bowl until each piece is well coated with flour. 4. Pour in the water, then, working quickly, use the knife to bring everything together to a rough dough. 5. Gather the dough in the bowl using one hand, then turn it onto a work surface. Squash the dough into a fat, flat sausage without kneading. Wrap in cling film, then chill the dough in the fridge for 15 minutes. 6. Lightly flour the work surface and the pastry. roll out the pastry in one direction until it's about 1 centimetre thick and 3 times as long as it is wide, or about 45 by 15 cm. Straighten up the sides with your hands now and again, and try to keep the top and bottom edges as square as possible. 7. Fold the bottom third of the pastry up, then the top third down, to make a block about 15 by 15 cm. That's 6 by 6 inches. It doesn't matter if the pastry isn't exactly the right size. The thing is that the corners are nice and square. 8. Turn the dough so that its open edge is facing to the right, like a book. Press the edges of the pastry together with a rolling pin. 9. Roll out and fold the pastry again, repeating this 4 times in all to make a smooth dough with buttery streaks here and there. If the pastry feels greasy at any point, or starts to spring back as you roll, then cover and chill it for 10 minutes before continuing. And now a recipe which incorporates puff pastry. This one is for chicken and mushroom pie. For this recipe, you will need 1 medium green pepper sliced, 50 grams, 20 ounces button mushrooms, 10 grams, half an ounce butter, 400 grams, 14 ounces cooked chicken shredded, 225 grams, 8 ounces puff pastry. Ready-made is fine, or you can use the recipe, obviously with different quantities that I gave you earlier. 1 egg beaten. For the sauce, 25 grams, 1 ounce butter, 25 grams, 1 ounce flour, 150 to 200 ml, 6 to 7 fluid ounces chicken stock, 2 to 3 tablespoons double cream, squeeze of lemon juice, sprig of fresh tarragon, and
this is what you do.
1. Preheat the oven to 220°C, that's 420°F, gas 7. 2. Blanch the pepper for 2 to 3 minutes in a saucepan of boiling salted water, then drain, refresh in cold water, and drain again. 3. Wipe the mushrooms and cut into quarters. Saute in the 10 grams half ounce butter for 2 to 3 minutes, then set aside. 4. For the sauce, melt the 25 grams 1 ounce butter in a heavy bottomed saucepan. Add the flour and cook slowly over a low heat until the mixture is straw coloured. Pour in the chicken stock, turn up the heat and stir constantly until simmering. Add the cream and reduce until the sauce has a syrupy consistency. Add the lemon juice and tarragon. 5. Turn off the heat, add the chicken, peppers and mushrooms to the pan. 6. Butter an oven-proof dish large enough to hold the chicken pie mixture with room to spare. Add the chicken mixture to the dish. 7. Roll out the pastry on a floured work surface to a thickness of about 0.25 inches, that's 1 centimetre. Place the pastry over the filling and carefully trim the edges. Use the trimmings to make cut-out shapes to decorate the surface of the pie. Cut a couple of air holes with a knife to allow the steam to escape. Brush the pastry with beaten egg. 8. Bake the pie in the preheated oven for about 25 to 35 minutes. The top should be nicely browned and the filling piping hot. Remove, allow to cool slightly, and serve. Next up, we have flaky pastry. Flaky pastry and rough puff are both similar to puff pastry, but easier and quicker to make. They are ideal for recipes where you want a flaky texture, but do not need the pastry to rise impressively. And incidentally, you can also use flaky pastry for the chicken pie recipe I've just given you. So, to make flaky pastry, you will need 225 grams, 8 ounces plain flour, pinch of salt, 80 grams, 3 ounces lard, 80 grams, 3 ounces butter. You don't have to use both lard and butter. I must admit, when I've made flaky pastry, I've just used butter and it's been absolutely fine. And
this is what you do.
1. Mix the flour with the salt and rub in half of the lard. Add enough cold water to bring the flour to a soft dough. 2. Mix together the rest of the lard and the butter. 3. Roll out the dough to make a rectangle 12.5 by 25 cm, that's 5 by 10 inches. 4. Dot 1/3 of the butter or butter and lard mixture over 2/3 of the rectangle. Fold the third without any fat on it over the middle third of the pastry. Bring the other third on top. Seal the edges with a rolling pin and turn the dough 90 degrees. Chill for 10 minutes. 5. Repeat stage 4 with half of the rest of the fat and then repeat one more time with the remaining fat. Chill for 10 minutes after each folding. And finally, we come to choux pastry. And choux pastry has a reputation for being difficult to master. And I would agree, there is a definite technique to making choux pastry, and it requires a lot of patience. I've only made it a few times, and it certainly hasn't come out perfectly every time. So, making choux pastry? Let's hear how.
It's time for choux pastry. It's that light-as-air casing for profiteroles and eclairs and no end of savoury fillings too. It always looks a bit fiddly, but is it any harder to get right than other types of pastry? We're about to find out as Lisa Benson joins me. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you.
Is it difficult? On a skill level of 1 to 10, what do you need for choux pastry?
I think you need a skill of about 8 and the patience of about 10.
All right.
It is just a bit technical, actually, to get it how you want it to get.
So it's the technique. Have you got to be very precise with this in your amounts and your measuring and what have you?
You do. With most baking, I think it's all about precision, but with choux bun, there's so many elements that could stack against you. Get them in the right place and you're going to get some good choux buns.
Right, so
out.
How do you get your choux buns right then, Lisa? Where do you start?
Start off by good quality ingredients, get them weighed out properly, get your oven preheated and get a thermometer in that oven as well. That's going to give you a good...
And the actual preparation, a lot of it's done on the hob, on
it
the
is,
top, isn't
yes.
it?
It is, yes. When I get, do you want me to get on with the,
yes,
the cooking
process
here?
I'll,
because
I'll
I've got a pan on and I've got some butter, some milk, a little bit of sugar in there, a little bit of water. And I don't know if you can hear this bubbling noise. I've got to get it to a good temperature, which it's just come to now. And I need to get into there some good quality plain flour.
Plain flour.
And the secret here is cooking out this flour, because if we don't cook it out properly...
I mean, that's glue, isn't it? You've just put...
It looks very much like glue. It is actually, and it goes into, which is a good reference, almost like a ball,
yes.
A glue ball.
Almost
and what we need to achieve is exactly that, onto a dry heat, starting to cook out this flour, and that is your first stages of your choux, really.
So if you get this wrong, you're doomed, are you? It'll be all lumpy and...
It can be lumpy. The instant of putting the flour in there gives you that instant ball.
I was going to say, you're keeping off the heat as well, because will that burn really quick?
It's a lot to do with the quality of your pan as well. I always say in cookery, a good heavy base pan, there's residual heating there, and that's just enough for me. And I'm holding it over the heat without directly touching the heat, and that's just enough to help me cook out that flour with all that steam coming through as well.
You're making two types of bun this morning, Lisa. A savoury one with smoked salmon and wasabi, and then a more traditional-looking sweet one with hazelnuts and filled with crème pâtissière, which looks absolutely going to be divine. divine. Is the actual choux recipe the same whether you're a savoury or a sweet bun, or does it have different ingredients?
You can alter it slightly, but I think it's really good if you have a recipe that works for both, because you can decide later on. They freeze fantastically. So a base of a choux is slightly bit of salt and slightly bit of sugar, and then you can turn them into the flavours later on. So it's quite a neutral base to really put some fantastic flavours.
So you'd have salt in the sweet one, sugar in the savoury one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You need that salt to bring out the sweetness, so they both work. It's a real good cavity for other flavours.
So you've made your dough ball in the pan, and now you've put it into the mixing bowl.
I have, and I've popped it into an earthenware bowl, and I'm just trying to cool this mixture, which is really important because
the steam coming
steam off. You can still see the steam in the bowl. I'd probably leave it a good few
don't
minutes
touch that,
because
yes.
I'm going to add some egg, and if this mixture's too hot, eggs scramble at temperatures you don't really want them to. So just to cool it off for a good few minutes is what I'd be looking for at this stage.
So tell me about what makes the choux bun unique is that it's actually very light and airy, isn't it? But then lovely and crisp on the outside. How do you get that? What causes that?
That's a lot to do with steam, and that's a lot to do with that hot temperature. 200 degrees in a hot oven, a bit like Yorkshire puddings, instantly get them in. The steam's created, the cavity gets pushed out, and then you need to dry it out, which is another part of choux buns. Don't take them out of the oven too early. They need to stay in that residual heat. The steam keeps them up, the shape up, and then the crust sets over.
A trick to getting it nice and steamy was to get your oven tray, run it under the tap, and then sort of get most of the water off. But so you've got a bit of water left on the tray, and that gives a lovely steamy atmosphere in your oven.
Absolutely, and lots of different recipes give you lots of different tips to do it. With ours, we don't need the steam. We've got a nice kind of soft dropping consistency. But, you know, sometimes putting a tray in the bottom to give some extra steam can help. But just check with your recipe first, because they don't all say the same thing.
Has that cooled down enough
it
to get on to the next stage?
Or are we going to have scrambled eggs? I'm just going to gradually get in, and the word here is gradually.
Yes.
Anytime you add egg, if you go too quickly, you're going to curdle.
You've beaten your eggs and you're just pouring them in.
I have. I've just lightly beaten them. And what I'm doing now is working the mixture against the side of the bowl in about 6 or 7 additions with this egg. And what we're really looking for with a recipe like this is, yes, by all means, follow your recipe. It's a really good recipe. But you're looking for a consistency, and we call it dropping consistency, because eggs are fairy. They're a natural product. Mm-hmm. And if you just stick to your recipe, sometimes it could be too runny. Sometimes you might need a little bit more egg. So I always think, make something by hand, know how it feels, know how it looks, and then you get good results every time.
Now we come to the bit. Now, this is what I like about this pastry. You don't actually need a rolling pin, do you? I'm not very good at rolling out pastry. You're actually spooning this lovely, gloopy, glossy mixture.
That's perfect. That glossiness is that real good emulsification with your egg. And that consistency I was talking about, we call that a reluctant
drop. That's actually
drop.
Not. There's about 2 seconds before that left the spoon and went back into the
that's
bowl.
That's perfect.
Yes.
If it's running off, you've got it too soft. If you're having to struggle...
It is a batter, isn't
spoon,
it? It's a thick batter. Whoa! Gosh,
there
I thought
go.
You missed the bag there.
Sorry. Good drop into the bag. It is a batter mix. That's a perfect description, really. And I'm just going to pop it into my piping bag now.
And you don't have to pipe. You could spoon it on if you don't mind irregular buns.
Absolutely. And I think that's the beauty of home baking. It doesn't all have to be perfection. This is just in a bag to help me get them out a little bit quicker. But if you can spoon them on, that's absolutely fine. I'm just going to pop them now onto my baking tray. And I have some parchment paper on my tray. And another tip, just put a couple of dollops of your mixture on the corners of your tray, and if you have a fan assisted oven, it stops that blowing up.
Oh, no,
and actually changing
yes,
the shape.
I'm always chasing bits of foil around my oven. Well, we're just running out of time, so you've actually made some, because we knew we wouldn't be able to do the whole thing. So I am going to actually have a little bite of the hazelnut one, which looks divine, and it's gone all over my script as I bit into it, but that's very sweet, isn't it? That's delicious.
Which is the beauty of having a neutral kind of profiterole, because you can then adjust your fillings. That's got the creme patisserie and a coffee mascarpone topping on top. So it is quite for the sweet tooth. And there is the savoury smoked salmon and wasabi if it's not your bag.
I'm going to save that for a little later. Lisa Bennison, thank you so much.
You're listening to the Voice.
So there we are. Several different types of pastry, several ways of making pastry and ways of using it. Some more difficult than others, but you know, to make a good quality pastry of whatever type, You need fresh, good quality ingredients, plenty of time, plenty of practice, and a lot of patience. If you were listening to last month's show, you'll remember that I set you a little teaser. I asked you, what are mushy peas? Now, I've had several answers, none of them correct, unfortunately. Peas that have been mushed is not exactly what I was looking for. Mushy peas are made with dried green peas. These need to be soaked overnight, and then they are cooked down until they resemble a somewhat lumpy porridge or paste. Sounds disgusting? Believe me, they are absolutely delicious, particularly with plenty of pepper. A very popular UK dish, mushy peas, as I said last month, eaten with fish and chips, even as a side dish, and eaten with other foods. I eat them at least once a week. They're absolutely delicious. If you'd like to contact the programme with queries, feedback, perhaps you'd like to share recipes or cooking experiences with other listeners, you can do so in the usual way by emailing cooking@theglobalvoice.info. That's COOKIN at theglobalvoice.info. To download or to listen to this programme again, go to theglobalvoice.info/gallery, or you can visit incx.org, where you can subscribe to the What's Cooking podcast. Well, that's all we have time for today. So until I'm with you again, this is Sue Hadfield saying, take care of yourselves and each other. And as always, happy cooking!